Thank you. My name is Patty Manolis and I'm the CEO of the Geelong Regional Library Corporation. Just a couple of housekeeping matters before we get things underway. Could you please check your mobile phone? And I must check mine when I get back to my seat and make sure it's turned on to silent or off completely, please. And should you need them, the toilets are located through this door at the back here. Before we commence, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather this evening, the Wathaurong, and I would also like to pay my respects to their elders, both past and present, and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians. It's my pleasure to welcome you all here tonight to the Warm Ponds Library. Tonight's event is part of a growing program presented by the Geelong Region's Libraries. Our aim is to enhance the cultural and literary experiences of the community through our lifelong learning offer, with events for all ages, which include author encounters like the one we're experiencing tonight, open mind lectures on a variety of topics and issues, programs for enhancing digital literacy, as well as a series of activities for kids and young people. Our summer What's On guide is hot off the press and on your seats. So if you could have a look at that, take it home and have a look at the delights on offer over the next 3 months. Our guest this evening, I'm going to turn to you now, John, started his writing career after quite an amazing list of other jobs, which I discovered in the back of the book. according to the information in his new book, these jobs have included the priesthood. Is that a job? Should I call that a job? A kitchen hand, a waiter, a masseur, a funeral assistant for two days. Yes. That must have been some job. A community development worker and a call centre operator. More recently, John has translated his love of reading to becoming an accomplished writer. His articles on social issues have been published widely throughout Australia and have examined the worlds of asylum seekers and people exploring their religion and their sexuality. According to former High Court Judge Michael Kirby, his stories are about the impact of repression on the human spirit and the way, despite all odds, humanity struggles endlessly against worldly authority. John also teaches writing and has worked as an editor and mentor. His first novel, Towards a Distant Sea, was published by Indra Publishing in 2005. In 2009, John self-published a collection of stories exploring the human condition, titled All Mortal Flesh. John Bartlett's second novel, Estuary, was published this year, and I'm very excited to hear John talk about it tonight. Please join me in warmly welcoming John Bartlett.
Thank you very much, Patty, for that kind introduction. And hello, everybody, friends and lovers of books and writing. If it's allowed, I want to also acknowledge the fact that we're meeting on the traditional country of the Wathaurong people here today, and to recognise and respect their cultural heritage, their beliefs and relationship with the land. And we acknowledge that they're of continuing importance to the Wathaurong people living today, and especially to the ancestors and elders. And I particularly want to acknowledge that paying respects to the ancestors, because it relates particularly to the story of the development of Estuary, the idea of influence of the ancestors. But I need to sort of talk more today, I think, about the process of writing, because that's the title of today's presentation. To talk to you a little bit about how Estuary came about, the whole process. The best way I can probably talk about it is, it's a bit difficult really, because it's a bit like cooking a Christmas cake and then afterwards getting the cake and taking it apart and taking out the currants and the raisins and the flour and the egg and the milk and trying to dissect it all out. It's a bit like that when you end up with a book and then you try and sort of dissect all the pieces and see where they all came from. It's such a slow, organic sort of thing coming together that it's very hard probably to describe. But what I can talk about is probably some of the influences on the book, how I came to write Estuary. And I guess it sort of happened really in 2005, just after I published my first novel, Towards a Distant Sea. I suddenly had this idea came into my head about my auntie. And What I did then in 2001, I wrote an article which was published in the Good Weekend magazine, in the Age Good Weekend, about my auntie, my mother's sister, who lived in Adelaide in the 1960s and 70s particularly, who was an artist and a musician, and quite successful in her own right. But at the same time, she was also incarcerated in a mental hospital in Adelaide for a number of years, and was treated in perhaps unkindly in that system in time when we didn't have perhaps such a good understanding of what mental illness was. And her life was really changed by the medication that she was on and the treatment that she received, the ECT treatment that she received, that really changed her life, that she became no longer a musician or an artist from then on. And I always thought that it was a life worth celebrating. Somebody needed to talk about their life because she was an amazing person. So that article was published in Good Weekend, and just as a little aside to that, it so happened that a few weeks afterwards I was contacted by the editor of The Age, who said that they'd been contacted by a woman in New South Wales who wanted to speak to me. And we made contact, and it turned out that this woman had been a pupil of my aunt's in Adelaide that time, and she'd gone on to be a musician, a music teacher, and a composer. And she believed that it was only because of my aunt's teaching that she'd done that. So it was a rather nice sort of closing of the circle that that had sort of happened. Thanks, Pat. Let's throw it away before I sell them all. So it was her, my aunt, Aunt Eulalie, as we called her, who was very much in my mind, who was sort of the jumping off point for this novel, Estuary. At the same time, another of my ancestors, not one that I didn't know myself, but my great-grandfather, Thomas Bartlett, who settled in Murray Bridge in South Australia on the Murray in the mid-19th century, the early history of that part of the world. And he was a bit of an entrepreneur. He cut down as many trees as he could and sold them. And he also established a quarry along the Murray River there. And he quarried stone for many of the prominent buildings of Adelaide, including the railway station that many of you probably know. And he became quite wealthy in doing that. It was something we sort of took for granted. And also, the money was lost in the family. There were stories that after his wife died, he actually married the barmaid of one of his hotels, and the money disappeared somehow. So it didn't quite come down to us. But over the years, I've sort of thought about how the fact that he was so successful also dislocated the local Indigenous people of that area, the Nurrungeri people along the Murray. But in some way, he was responsible for them losing their land and losing their identity. And those two people, I suppose, those two ancestors, very much in my mind when I was thinking about writing Estuary. The other influence, I suppose, a very connected one, was the whole idea of memories, connection with memories, and also landscapes. It was the idea of sort of landscape for me growing up. I grew up in Murray Bridge, so I grew up along the Murray. That whole sort of landscape area, the Murray, the Lower Lakes, and the coast along South Australia, where we used, as a family, we used to go every summer for our holidays in a caravan. That whole sort of landscape became very much part of my life and my, I suppose, my family's DNA, really. And there's many sort of family stories. One of our famous family stories is my father, at the age of 12, rescued another boy from drowning in the Murray, and that became sort of part of our family story. So that whole sort of idea of ancestors, memories of the landscape, what I sort of call probably now the lure of landscape. I was lured in later years of that landscape of my childhood. It was very much sort of lodged somewhere in here, and something that affected my writing of this book. I suppose that, you know, it's like a family DNA, really. So as well as those two influences, the other area that I suppose influenced my writing was and research too, which is what writers have to do. So I went to the Coorong particularly a number of times, and I spent time there talking to people, just being there, talking to the Nurrungeri people, and listening to their stories, some of their stories which I've used in the telling of this story, and just spending time in the landscape, I suppose, just trying to absorb the feeling of the landscape. That was important in the writing of the book too. And other influences, I guess, were some historical backgrounds. This is not an historical novel by any means. I don't consider myself an historical writer. But there were some sort of historical aspects that form part of that story. For example, the fact that in the 19th century also, Chinese gold prospectors were let off the ship in Robe in South Australia, and they had to walk from Robe across the Bendigo to the goldfields, because if they'd been brought to Victorian ports, the captain of the ship would have to pay a tax on each of them leaving the ship. So the easiest thing was to dump them all in Robe, and then they had to walk across to the goldfields. So that was also, that historical fact was part of the story too. Other sort of stories were I don't know if you remember some years ago, the whole sort of fracas in South Australia about Hindmarsh Island, about building a bridge to Hindmarsh Island, and the reaction from the Indigenous women of the area who resisted it. But they were sort of publicly disgraced, really, as having made up stories that weren't true, which was a big public humiliation for them, really. So that historical fact too. And just the fact of the stolen generation, I guess, sort of weighs heavily in this story too. And the other sort of indulgence, I suppose, which was an influence, is that I got to play with my own ideas on race, sexuality, differences between people in telling this story. And it's quite an indulgence to be able to actually put on the page, you know, what you believe about people and human nature and how we ought to involve with each other. But of course, Estuary is neither my aunt's story nor my great-grandfather's story, and it's not a treatise on issues. It's not a sermon. I mean, it would be as dull as ditch water if it was. It's a work of fiction. So somehow along the line, this is where the creative imagination has to take over, and I don't really understand this process. I can't explain this process. But all these fragments that sort of came up through research and through my ideas and the historical sort of facts have to then be reworked into some sort of a fictional story. And a lot of this process doesn't happen at the desk for me. A lot of it happens walking on the beach, driving the car, shopping in a supermarket, just subconscious dreaming perhaps, because it does seem to be sort of a subconscious thing that sort of happens, and I don't understand, and see other writers here in the audience nodding too, because we don't really know how it happens, but thank goodness it does happen. It doesn't always seem to be down to us. Somehow there is a subconscious thing that happens, and these things do eventually sort of come together. So the story, I guess, must be fitted together almost like a giant jigsaw. I'm not probably going to say a lot today about the actual self-publishing, which is what I did in the end, except to say that at some point in the writing process, one realises that there has to be some sort of a professional judgment on what you've written. So at the point where you're happy, you think that you've done as much as you can do, the work has to then be submitted to a professional assessor who then looks at the work and then, you know, decides, you know, whether it's worth proceeding with. And I guess for me then, that was the first sort of time I thought, well, maybe there is something in this, because the person that assessed it, professional assessor, said, yeah, I think this is good stuff here. I think you know there are things here you need to change, things you need to consider. So then it goes through another whole sort of process of being reassessed, and then without going through sort of probably the boring part, which is the actual, you know, further manuscript assessment, rewriting, and then taking on an editor who's going to go through the process and add more suggestions. I lost count of the rewrites. I'm not quite sure how many rewrites there were, but there were a lot of rewrites until, you know, it's satisfactory in your own mind. I'm probably not going to say anything about the fact of trying to submit to publishers, because I think that's such a difficult thing, but I was rejected by most Australian publishers, which is a pretty common experience too, so that's why I went down the road of self-publishing. I'm happy to answer questions afterwards, but what I was also going to do was just to do probably just three short readings. But then, with the marvels of technology, I realised that I can actually play for you too. As part of this whole process was to put together a marketing campaign, and part of that marketing campaign was to put together a YouTube video to promote the book, which many of you have probably seen. But I will just sort of show it now, because to me it sort of very much picked up the feeling of the book. It really sort of grasped that what I was trying to put across, I suppose, in terms of the emphasis, the ideas I wanted to put across, sort of make it a sort of a something that people might be interested in seeing. So I'll just play that, and then perhaps I'll just do three short readings, and then perhaps allow for questions after that. So I think so.
Alison,
do you
know
what
to do? Yes, I've got shown. Fantastic.
have to confess, the first time I saw that finished product, I was actually in tears. So I think somehow it actually it very much captured the feeling of the book, which is what I wanted to do. Now, some of you may be asking, well, what the hell is the book about? It's about a nephew who returns from Victoria to South Australia for the funeral of his aunt. Seth is a nephew, and his aunt is Aunt Leela, an artist and a musician, of course. And in coming back for the funeral, he meets a friend. He's been separated from his aunt for 20 more years, even though she was responsible in helping to bring him up when his mother died. So he sort of has just absented himself from Adelaide in South Australia, really, and knew little about his aunt's life. But in coming back for her funeral, he meets up with a very close friend of hers, Ruby, an Aboriginal woman from the Coorong, and her son, Kubbaji. And by making contact with them, he's sort of drawn back into finding out things about his aunt that he knew nothing about, nothing about her illness or her life, nothing about her connection to the Indigenous people. And so he's sort of perhaps unwillingly drawn back into her life and his connection with Ruby and with her son, and revelations about his own family that he knew nothing about, and secrets that, you know, had been covered up in his past. And I guess it's a journey for him, a journey of discovery about himself and his family and about himself as well. And at the base, I suppose, it's a love story. You'd be relieved to know that it's a love story. It's not a sermon. And I guess the readings I want, looking back on the story, you know, when you're actually writing something, you're not really aware sometimes of what it is, what it's about, I think. And sometimes looking back and hearing people respond, you sort of see things that you hadn't seen when you were writing. And I suddenly sort of realised that Estuary, I suppose, is about connections between people. And there's sort of three prominent sort of love relationship connections in this story. And the readings I want to do sort of relate to those sort of connections. So the first one is really the connection between Leela, this is set in 1938, between Leela and her saxophonist boyfriend, Frankie, who's just about to get on the train to head off to the war. So I'll just read that section first. Leela wonders if she should tell Maggie, and Maggie's her sister, about Frankie. No, not yet. She's not like Maggie, blabbing about every boy who looks sideways at her. That'd break the magic. Frankie can be her little secret for a bit longer. He's like no one she's ever met before. God, now she sounds like Maggie. Wild, mad when he starts playing the saxophone. Nothing like her and her safe little minuets. Frankie's 18, a year younger than her, but he's already playing at a club in Hindley Street, though he's still at the conservatorium. She's not been there yet to hear him play. God, her father would kill her, or at least take her out of the con if he heard she'd been down that part of the city with its nightclubs and brothels. When Frankie plays, music is disturbing. The notes get under your skin, sweet and hypnotic at first, and then you feel as if the music has gotten inside you and replaced your own blood. You've been invaded without knowing it, and your body wants to move in ways you never expected. Leela had not been aware of her body before she heard Frankie play. Well, not in the same way. It used to be something that got her from one place to the other, something she rewarded with food or sleep at the proper times, and then in exchange, she expected that it wouldn't let her down like a bicycle with a puncture. But with Frankie's playing, she felt as if something had loosened inside her, a feeling that made her want to do what no one else was doing, to paint pictures that no one else has yet tried. Leela shivers. So that's the first relationship that story talks about. The second relationship I'd like to sort of read about is the relationship in later years, in the 1980s really, between Leela and her Indigenous friend Ruby, who's really the person who rescues Leela from the mental hospital and takes care of her. And this is one of the episodes that sort of displays that friendship between them. She's kneeling at the edge of the water. She's naked and shivering. It's early afternoon and the beach appears deserted. Ruby rushes down the length of the beach, pulling off her long winter coat as she runs. There was nobody in the house when she got home from work. Both the front and studio doors were wide open. Papaji would still be at school, but where the hell was Leela? There was no sign in the kitchen that anybody had eaten lunch. The breakfast dishes were still unwashed in the sink where she'd left them earlier that morning. A fly had slowly drowned in the curdling milk in the cereal bowl. As Ruby gets closer, her thick heels sink into the soft sand. It's impossible to run in them, and she stops and wrenches off her shoes. Leela's head is bowed. Is she praying again, or just carrying on one of those private conversations she lapses into sometimes? It's hard to tell. It's okay, Auntie. You can come home now. Ruby drapes her coat around Leela's shaking shoulders and buttons it around her. She's become tinier and tinier in the last few months. They told me to come here because my brother and sister are trying to murder me. They said it would be safe here. Yes, Leela, you're safe now. We can go home. Ruby lifts Leela slowly to her feet, and the old woman stumbles in the sand. Ruby needs to help, but Kapaji won't be home for at least an hour. She could leave Leela and run to the school for him. It's not far, but she dare not leave Leela alone. The beach is deserted. No wonder. It's meant to be spring, but there's an icy southwesterly blowing off the gulf. Stumbling together up the beach, the two women manage to reach a seat at the edge of the car park. It's gritty with seagull droppings, but they flop down together. Leela's eyes are open now, and she seems to recognise Ruby for the first time. Why did you bring me down here? The seven sisters were always doing things their own way, but one day Narunjiri from his cave at Gulwa decided it was time to bring them back to him. They're standing now, and Leela seems stronger, so they start to walk back across the car park to the road. At least it's easy to walk here, and they stop while Ruby puts on her shoes. The other thing I just sort of forgot to mention when I was talking about influences and things that sort of fed into the story was that I was able to get hold of my auntie's medical records from the hospital in Adelaide in South Australia, and I've used them in the telling of the story too. So that was quite a personal sort of story. And I've dedicated the book to her too, which was very important for me. Now, the last sort of relationship or love relationship that I'd like to draw attention to that occurs in this book is the relationship between Seth and between Kapaji, Ruby's son. I wanted Kapaji around, but at the same time, I wanted him gone. He was young enough to be my son, but I didn't feel very fatherly towards him. I was more an equal, or perhaps even a pupil. He seemed calm, while all the while I was churned up inside. I couldn't admit to anyone, but I was fascinated by his sheer physicality, the way he inhabited his own body so easily. I watched him working sometimes when he couldn't have known I was watching, the way his limbs moved, his head turned, or his easy laugh when I had realised I was being funny. In the end, of course, he'd leave, go back to the lakes, and I just have these days to remember. Maybe that wouldn't be enough. And I'll just go on then to another event, which is where the two of them go surfing, and actually go surfing at Point Impossible, just down the road. We surfed for a couple of hours out on the reef, and the waves were plenty big enough for me. I was still trying to keep my feet, but the excitement of being carried on the muscle of the wave made me forget the limitations of my body. It was starting to get dark when we dragged ourselves out of the surf and leaned against the car. I was exhausted. Your people used to camp down here in the summer, here at the mouth of the creek. I heard they used to build fish traps here. I offered this snippet of information like a gift to Kapaji. Not my mob, Seth. We're not all from the same mob, you know. I couldn't stop the heat and embarrassment rising from my neck to my face. Kapaji must have noticed and added, still, they must have been a bit like us, though, camping here in the estuary where the river meets the sea. Like us. Good, sexy place, like I told you. And he laughed suddenly and unexpectedly. It was his turn to look embarrassed. We were changing out of our wetsuits as he spoke, and he turned away quickly, but I caught sight of the way his wetsuit exposed the beginnings of the hot curve of his buttock. I felt a sudden and unexpected ache in my stomach, sharp as pain. Then Kapaji turned back towards me, his hands over his eyes, squinting into the distance. His belly, with its soft downy hair, curved away into the hidden darkness of his wetsuit. I wanted to see more, to carry away with me the secret revelations of this young man. But this was wrong. This man was so unaware of the effect this casual turning down of his wetsuit was having on me, ignorant of the unconscious seduction of my private thoughts. Kapiji looked up at me and grinned. "What's up?" I turned away from him and peeled the skin of my wetsuit down my arms. It always felt like I was being skinned alive, and the cold wind stung my flesh and I felt goosebumps. Kapiji was shaking now too, and I had a sudden need to reach out and hold him, to warm him and stop him shivering. "Come on, Kapiji, let's stop pissing about. I want to hit the road and beat all the traffic." So there's more lies ahead, more difficulty. Okay, that's probably the only readings I'm going to do, so I'm happy to take any questions if people want to ask.
All right. You mentioned it's like a large jigsaw. When did you start having some idea as to the shape or to, you know, what you were telling?
It's a really difficult question to know when the shape sort of started to make itself aware. I think I knew pretty clearly from the beginning that my art was, story was going to be sort of central somehow to the story. But it took quite a long time before those other sort of elements started to come together and then I could see that it, you know, it could be a story. It probably took a few years, I think, really. Because I worked very slowly, I think, and all those visits to the Koorong and all that reading, I did quite a bit of reading too, on the Nurundjeri particularly and their customs and, you know, how they lived. I'd say it probably was a few years before that sort of story came together. But some of it did come together automatically. And I have to say, probably one of the most difficult things was to get the dates right, to sort of work out, because the story is told sort of almost in alternating chapters between the past and the present, between Leela's story and Seth's story in the present. So getting the years and their ages right and doing lots of adding up and taking away, I think that was one of the most challenging things, to make sure that the ages were consistent. So I can't quite probably put my finger on it, you know, time-wise, but it was a very slow process, I know that.
That's encouraging.
Anybody else?
Christine. I'm interested, John, to... sometimes when I'm just writing, I just herniate it. You know, I say, oh, it's time to go there, just stop. And, you know, and people say, we didn't want you to stop there. How do you know when you've done enough? How do you know when you've got to the end?
Perhaps when you're just worn out, you think there's not really much more you can say. I think I tend to sort of underwrite rather than overwrite. So I always need somebody like an assessor or someone to say, look, you do need to write more. It might be in your head, but it's not on the page yet. So I am one of those people who needs a bit of a push. Most of the stuff I write is pretty short. My first novel was reasonably short, and, you know, my short stories were short. So, yeah, I tend to stop too soon sometimes, I think. Even though I think you need that stopping time to let it sort of simmer and put it away for a while, and certainly the idea started in 2005, so what, I've had 8 years for it to be cooking away, so it's been a long process. Yes.
So how long would you spend writing a day?
I don't seem to have a regular sort of system like that. I'm pretty disorganised. My partner's smiling. I'm pretty disorganised and I'm not very, you know, I'm not one of those people who must write every day. I sort of write when I feel like it, really. I guess that's why it's taken so long. Or I need to write other things too, because I have been writing other things in the meantime, essays and features and stuff for my website and for other websites and that too. And I like that balance. I don't like to be just focused on the one thing. I find that too difficult. I like to have about 3 or 4 different things going at once. Seems to help the process somehow.
And when are you how do you go about getting an assessor and an editor? Do you look up the phone books or anything?
Well, I suppose when you're sort of writing for a while, through different networking and that, you become aware of sort of people who know people, who sort of have a good reputation. And when I was writing my short stories, I actually had a local editor, because it was part of my MA degree, so I had a local editor sort of involved in the process. And she had a friend in Sydney who was a good manuscript assessor, who she thought was good, and I sent it to her, and she did the assessing. She assessed my short stories, and I was so impressed with the pages of stuff that she wrote that I went back to her and She was an excellent assessor. So sort of networking, really, I think.
It's a very different question.
I was just curious
how you went about it. So how do you network?
You go to author events and you go to book launches and you join book groups and go to bookshops and join, you know, book groups and...
Like for the Writers' Centre and...
Yes, yeah, all those things. Geelong Writers, the Victorian Writers' Centre, you know, all those groups are huge supports. I mean, I've really only been writing for 13 years and all my supports come from all those groups and those people. So just getting out and about, I think, and, you know, making links and connections, I think it's the most valuable thing.
And that, wonderful, was that on YouTube, did you say?
Yes, it was, yeah.
And you just do it and you just put it on YouTube?
Yes, I didn't do it. I had somebody do it professionally, yeah, because I had the ideas for it and the text and that, but I had somebody do it professionally for me, yeah. I wouldn't try and do that.
No, but it's very good.
Well, I think it hits the spot. Yeah, it did for me, true. Yeah, it did.
How big an influence was
Well, I suppose it's an estuary, isn't it? Yeah, it seemed to be finally living in estuaries all the time. Yeah. My original title for the book was The Waking Girl. I've got a painting at home of my aunt's that she did. And it's a picture of a river and a bridge across the river, and there's a girl standing on the bridge, and she's looking back towards a man rowing in a boat towards her. And I just always thought that that was sort of symbolic of her life. She was waiting perhaps for a better time when, you know, she might have been treated differently perhaps, whether she's waiting for a husband or a father or a lover or whoever she's waiting for. But that never happened for her. She never married or she never had a relationship because of, you know, what happened to her. So I always found that sort of title, The Waiting Girl, was sort of my working title. The manuscript assessor said that it wouldn't work because it was more than just about that, it was much more. So the idea of estuary is that sort of idea of the meeting of differences. And I mean, the estuary, Brimley and other estuaries, is all about the seawater and the freshwater meeting, and that's a very fertile sort of place. That's where fish breed, that's where all the food is. And like Cubbagee says, it's a really sexy place, it's a really good place. So I suppose Brimley's fits into that category. Altona, where the Yarra meets the sea in Melbourne. That's Altona, isn't it?
Williamstown.
That gets a chapter in there too. So there's estuaries everywhere if you sort of come to look around for them. All right.
Two questions. One, so there's Ruby and Leela in later life. So are there three time periods, or is that one just?
I sort of started out, there was sort of two definite time periods. There was the present, when Seth goes back to Adelaide for his aunt's funeral, and then the next chapter goes back to the 1930s when Leela's just, you know, she's a young girl and she's at the conservatory studying music. And then there's sort of quite, that alternates backwards and forwards, and then it sort of telescopes a little bit, and then I think I stopped doing the backwards and forwards, and it just sort of does the present time thing.
And the Narrandri, I used to live in the Northern Territory, and I mean, I'm thinking about 8 or 9 years ago, there was a really big thing going on at that time between non-Indigenous writers and Indigenous, just the question of appropriation,
yes,
and stories and things.
Yes.
And I just wonder how, I mean, I struggle with that myself.
Yes.
How do you deal with that?
Yes, really good question, because I really struggle with that too. You know, I wanted to tell this story, but you know, I had a lot of misgivings about, you know, me as a white writer, what right have I to sort of talk about Aboriginal characters, Indigenous characters? But I think in the end I sort of came to think, and as part of the story, I've used three Narrandjeri stories in here, which I asked permission to use, and they gave me permission to use them. But I think I came to the think that the idea that writers write about other people, men, male writers, women, female writers, men, you know, I think you can sort of take that too far.
Yeah.
I think writers have to sort of write other people. And as long as you respect the characters, and also I didn't want to make the Indigenous characters all good either. I think that's patronising to do that. So Cubbagee is a bit of a mixed character, really. He's not really all good. So it's about sort of treating them like human beings, I suppose, really, is how I came to terms with it myself. And interestingly, the last Melbourne Writers' Festival, I interviewed a Indigenous woman writer, Abby Colby Eckerman, who's actually got relatives in Brimley. And I said to her, because my, part of writing this, I felt, was I have to acknowledge the fact that my great-grandfather played a part in the dispossession of the Indigenous people. That's true. Have to acknowledge that. But should we be stuck in that? Isn't it time to sort of try and move past that to something else? And I asked her, and she said, well, you have to acknowledge it. You have to keep on acknowledging it, because a lot of people won't acknowledge it yet. So you have to keep on pushing that. But I said, but isn't there more? And she said, well, the other thing we have to move on to do is just to be together as friends, is the way she put it. So, you know, with that sort of justification, I suppose, I thought, I can write about these people, you know, with respect, and respect their stories as well, but, you know, have a go at writing about those sort of characters. That's how I came to terms with it anyway. I haven't been hit by a bolt of lightning yet.
Sometimes the story is quite not told.
That's right, yeah. And that was part of the... I knew the story had to be told. There was something sort of forcing me to tell it, needed to be told, and it had to involve those characters, so it had to be told.
The person who assessed your book...
Yes.
It was a lady, was it?
Yes, it was,
she,
yes.
Was she a complete stranger to you?
Oh, yes, totally. I've never, yeah.
And that would be highly desirable, really.
Oh, I think so, yes.
Because yeah. I find it very difficult when my wife writes a story and I edit it, but yes. I'm a de facto assessor as yes. well, you know, what yes. to think about it. And
yes.
And it's very difficult in that sort of... situation.
Well, I think one does give one's writing to one's wife or husband or partner, and mostly they'd say, well, it's good. Yeah, it's good. But what you really want is, well, it's good, but you know, you maybe should have done this or done that. So, yeah, I think you have to have somebody that's on, totally on a professional sort of basis. Yeah. I have met her since. I had coffee with her in Sydney, but you know, since. Not, it was all done sort of over distance.
Yes. Fair enough.
No, but the thing is, with him, he's very good because when he reads through my stories, if they make sense,
yes.
because if you're writing them every day, you're only doing a bit. So if he reads them through and then says, well, that doesn't make sense, or you've left out a bit. So I use him sort of as a sounding
board. Yeah. I think you do know that initial sort of response, yeah. don't you? Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And I think I've sort of given my stories bits and pieces to people close to me, trying to get a response in. Yeah.
Pardon. I'm interested in the self-publishing aspect, and in particular the artwork that you chose. How
did
you tell us about that?
Yes, I had it professionally done, but there was a lot of information sort of went into that. Partly my partner, who was an artist, was responsible for the input into that and some of the decisions about that. Stephen, thank you, Barry. And I think we sort of put in ideas, fed ideas to her, but it was sort of the idea of, it wanted it to sort of look a bit like an estuary, and also to sort of pick up the idea of Indigenous colours, and art, I suppose, is the other thing. It's hard to sort of put a finger on it, really, but there were some original sort of designs that were done that just were wrong, I suppose, just didn't work. They were more sort of probably silhouettes of in estuaries, which is just a bit sort of prosaic. So with that sort of input and with the professional sort of person doing it, it sort of came together okay.
Did you not, because my question is connected, did you not think of digital publishing?
It is an e-book as well, yeah.
So you've done both?
I've done both, yeah. And it's available on my website as an e-book and as a hard copy, yeah. Any more questions?
One more for me.
Paddy.
You write non-fiction, fiction and essays. I just wonder if the process is different and whether you have a bent in a particular way or a preference.
No, I don't think, off the top of my head, I don't think I have a preference. I think when I was saying before, I like to have three or four things going at once. I really do.
Writing.
Yeah, I like, I suppose they're different. They're all about sort of getting the right words and saying what you want to say, you know, in the best possible way, I suppose. So, yeah, I don't think I have a preference for one or the other, but I like the variety. I don't think I want to be concentrating on one thing only at one time. I seem to need that sort of variety and stimulation of different things.
Mm-hmm.
seems to work for me. Maria?
I'm just wondering, as a writer, when you watch films or if you attend plays, because you're aware of how stories are structured and maybe the narrative arc, and do you tend to critically overlook what to some people may be more relaxing?
Yes, I think I do. Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, I love films, and yeah, I'm always sort of thinking about how it fits together, or thinking in a visual sort of way, because I'd like to think that I write and try to write in a visual sort of way too. So yeah, it is all about that stimulation, that you have that sort of feeding into you all the time, stimulated by films and music and plays and that whenever you can, and all that sort of stuff. I think really helps. It's part of the whole process, I think. Particularly films, probably, yeah, because of that sort of structure. You're sort of assessing the structure. It's, you don't always just sort of sit back and, you know, relax with it. You're sort of assessing and how that worked and, you know, about that bit, and maybe that could sort of work with the book. And
it's like a little muscle.
You're doing it all the time.
Christine? John, you said you're very busy writing articles and features and teaching and everything. And people always seem to say you can't write unless you read. Do you actually have time to read?
Well, I do. I read a lot. Stephen's shaking his head.
I just wonder what sort of things you're reading while you're writing this book, just like anything that comes or... I don't mean the intentional reading you're doing in your research.
No.
I mean recreational reading.
Yeah. Mm. I love Australian fiction. I think, Australian fiction and short stories are probably the things I read the most. Crime. I read a lot of crime now. Because there's so much good crime writing now, you know, with characters and, you know, storylines and everything, and really terrific stuff. I love Australian, Australian fiction. So I suppose that's what I predominantly read.
Going on from that, what this lady is here saying, do you find yourself deconstructing as you go along?
Do I find what's it?
Deconstructing as you go.
Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think you can't help it. If you're sort of engaged in some sort of writing process, you're assessing at the same time, aren't you? And thinking, oh, that works. And but a lot of the time, you're thinking, oh, a fantastic sentence. You know, I think I can say that. I can't say that. And for a long time, I sort of said that to myself. Oh, I could never write like that. But then finally, you think, no, I could never write like that. But I can write something, and maybe that's okay. That's what sort of accept, I suppose, in the end.
Thanks.
But yeah, I'm all the time sort of reading and beating a path to the library.
Oh, that's good to know.
Between home and Torquay, there's a rut in the road, I think, for me. And I tend to sort of, you know, I see reviews of books, I hear about books, so get online and sort of put them on hold, then come home with about 10 books. And I don't read them all, but, you know, I'll go through and perhaps keep two or three and read them. But yeah, I've sort of got stuff coming in all the time.
What is it that makes you want to write, John?
Oh. I don't know, just there's some sort of something, there's some passion, or there's some, something happens, you know, when you come up with a good sentence. There's such a feeling of euphoria that you think, oh, I created that, it's the best thing. Well, it's just, it's like a drug, I suppose, really. Just, I don't know, some sort of a need to do it. I say in my website that I was castigated at the age of 6 in St. Joseph's Convent Primary School in Murray Bridge by Sister Bernadette, because I used to use big words, and she said, you know, you should stop using those big words, you shouldn't be, you should be using simpler words. So I think I had it from an early age, really.
What books do you read?
I read a lot of Australian fiction.
Yes.
I can't think of too many titles off the top of my head. Tim Winton, Christos Tsolkas, a lot of women writers, crime writers. I can't.
Everything. You get a lot of books and read.
I do, yeah. But I suppose as short stories particularly, I love collections of short stories. But if I was to choose any group, it would be Australian fiction, American fiction. I love American fiction, especially the Deep South stuff. Ron Rash, Cormac McCarthy, that sort of. I like the dark sort of stuff. That's one thing I like, the crime stuff too. I'm interested in all that sort of the dark psychology of human beings and what they get up to.
I'm just wondering if you had did you have any interest in writing as a youngster?
The Sister Bernadette reckon I had too much of an interest. That was the trouble.
And did you come from a family of readers and avid?
No, not particularly. My mother read romance fiction a lot. we weren't not great readers in the family, I don't think. And then I didn't really read or write really for a long time. I just went on and did other things, and then just in recent years I thought, this is what I really want to do. If I get hit by a tram tomorrow, it's the one thing I'd regret not trying. Keep on. You never knew Sister Bernadette.
No, but the nuns in my school gave me my love of literature.
Yes.
From the age of about 10 or 11.
That wasn't the Loretto sisters, was it?
No.
Because they were very good at that.
Saint Joseph.
Oh, Saint Joseph, yeah. Mm. Oh, well, we had different nuns in charge.
Oh, I think they get a bad press, the nuns.
Just Sister Bernadette, I won't knock the others.
I'm really pleased to hear you like reading Australian fiction, because it's actually going to be a special feature of our new Geelong Library and Heritage Centre.
Oh,
I hope you've all heard about that great project. Seeing as the fellow who was going to stop the project wasn't voted in as mayor on the weekend, it is going ahead.
Oh, I didn't know about any of that.
Yes, yeah. Crazy platform. Anyway, I was not having any of that. But Australian fiction and its location in the cultural precinct, we felt that it would be appropriate. Now, we've got Torquay Books with us tonight. So the book is for sale, and I'm sure, John, you won't mind signing a few copies.
I'll have to.
And I just wanted to thank you. I think hearing from the author always adds another dimension and pleasure to reading a book. So I wanted to thank you personally for that. And if you could please all join me in thanking John. Please do look out for our forthcoming events. As I said earlier, our program is on your seats. And if you do have some time to fill in the evaluation form, it does actually help us plan better for future events. So I'd be very grateful if you could do that before you leave.
And can I just quickly thank the library too for this, for my own event and for the other marvellous events that the library has been running for a number of years now. Some really wonderful events.
Thank you.
Thanks.